is David Swanson at the People Speak Radio Network. It's great to be back here again for another show, and it's especially great to have the guest we have for the next hour, Aidan Delgado, who is a veteran of the Iraq War and one of the very few who has become a conscientious objector in Iraq. He's now a peace activist, and he's the author of The Sutras of Abu Ghraib. He has a website at AidanDelgado.com. Aidan, it's great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Can you give us a little bit of background before we get into what happened in Iraq? I understand you grew up traveling the world a little bit.
I did. My father was a U.S. diplomat. He was a member of USAID, the Agency for International Development. So I lived all over. I spent probably the first 7 years of my life in Thailand, and then a number of years in Senegal, and finally the last 7.5 years in Cairo, Egypt, where I became familiar with Arabic and Egyptian society, which really conditioned the way I saw things and the way I behaved when I was later deployed to Iraq. So honestly, I only came to America in the year 2000 to attend my undergraduate at the New College of Florida.
And then you joined the military on September 11th, but not, as that might imply, because of September 11th, correct?
Yeah, it was one of the great ironies that I was in the recruitment station on the morning of September 11th when everything happened. So this was the fulfillment of a long process, maybe a week-long process of enlistment, and it was just by sheer chance that I was there while it was happening. But it was actually a very profound moment for me because I looked around at everybody panicking and everything going into pandemonium, and initially I felt vindicated. I felt, well, this is the absolute worst-case scenario. This is the very reason we have a military, and I'm glad I joined initially. Obviously, in the years that followed, and including my service to the Iraq War, those feelings began to change. But initially, I think it was good because to experience what might be called the ultimate rationale for being in the military.
And you were about 19 at the time?
I was 18.
You're 18. And do you mind me asking, are you now 25, 24?
I am 25, yeah.
You're 25 now. And so you were deployed to Iraq right after shock and awe, right?
I was. I was deployed about the second or third week of the war, so after the initial bombing and then the blitz of all the main units going over. And my unit was a secondary company of a military police who sort of followed in the wake of the first wave.
And so I imagine at this point you're already having different thoughts from when you joined up, but just to back up for a second, why did you join to begin with?
Well, you know, this is something I've been asked 100 times and I've never been able to satisfactorily answer. All I can say is that it was complex and it had to do with a number of things. Mostly, I felt very out of place at my college. This was my first time in America, and I wasn't doing well academically. I had a difficult time fitting in, and I thought I needed some kind of purpose or direction in my life, and I thought that the military would provide that. And in the years since then, looking back on it, I've been able to relate that to what I think is a larger trend, which is that for young people, especially young men, there's a very unclear marker between being a boy, being an adolescent, and then being an adult. And one of the few institutions we have left that is a formal rite of passage and a marker of adulthood is to serve in the military. And I think that, regrettably, a lot of young people enter the military because they want to be seen as now full members of society, and they want someone from outside to come and say, you are now a complete adult. And that's one of the things that the military provides. And I think that I was doing that, too. I think I was looking for some kind of challenge or some kind of rite of passage, if you will. I think that's largely what motivated me to join. I mean, it wasn't patriotic, and it wasn't really for any kind of benefit. It was more a personal thing or a development thing.
Right. And when did you start to notice significant differences in attitude and opinions between yourself and your comrades in the military? My understanding is even before you went to Iraq, you began to notice certain attitudes toward Arabs that were not.
Yeah, I mean, well, truthfully, my objections began very shortly after entering the military. One of the fallacies I tried and dispel is the idea that conscious objectors are fine with being in the military, then they go to war and suddenly they discover they have a problem, which is almost never the case. Usually, at some point in their military enlistment, when they start to get an experience of what the military is, and this can happen as early as training, people begin to say, well, they begin to question their decision when they understand more completely what the military is about. And for me, I became a Buddhist, or I started becoming interested in Buddhism shortly after I enlisted. I had a month or two before I had to go to basic training. And this was really the beginning of my Buddhist education and my Buddhist development. And so I began to look at events through that new lens. Having become a Buddhist, I was now looking at the world from a Buddhist perspective. And I began to look at the military in training, in advanced training, look at the attitudes that not only existed, but that they were fostering about Arabs, about Muslims, the usual kind of rah-rah, kill the enemy, but more so, and with a particular venom and a particular ferocity that was new to me. And also to begin to question the very project of the military and whether it was something I, as a Buddhist, could be a part of. And over a year later in Iraq, I finally took a stand on that. But it was something that began very early, and it was catalyzed by the behavior of the soldiers around me, but more so the behavior of the administration or the institution of the military in the way it trained soldiers to be unthinking, unfeeling instruments and or to feel hatred and racism and aggression towards strangers. And this was something that I felt was wrong and that I couldn't be a part of.
Do you think that your colleagues headed over to Iraq were motivated as much by racism and xenophobia and sadism as by whatever they were supposed to be motivated by, this idea that they were seeking revenge for 9/11, even though Iraq had nothing to do with it, or protecting the world from weapons of mass destruction, even though they didn't exist? Or what motivated others to go over there? Or was it simply that you've been ordered to go over there, you must go over there?
Well, I think that the order was a huge part of it. I wouldn't say that they were motivated solely or even largely by xenophobia or racism. I think those were things that came out later. But what you mentioned, the key aspect, which was defense or protecting the world from September 11th, and that was something I heard expressed many times by commanders, by individual soldiers on the ground, the feeling that this was in some way a defensive war, even as we crossed the border into someone else's country.
Right.
There was this idea of protection, or that we're defending our own. And so I think that was a profound psychological motivator, and it liberated people from the idea that they were doing something aggressive. That in their mind, they could think of themselves as defenders and therefore be okay with it. But to my eyes, you know, as we rolled across the borders of two countries that weren't ours, I perceived that as an aggressive act. And naturally, I was beginning to have humanitarian objections, but the racism and the xenophobia, I think, was something that conditioned the way soldiers behaved when they were in Iraq, but it didn't condition why they entered Iraq.
Yeah. I want to get to how you came to take a stand, but first I want to announce that this recording will be all over the Internet, but there may be people listening live as we speak and can call in toll-free to ask questions of Aidan Delgado. In the U.S. and Canada, you can call toll-free 888-228-4494 to reach the People Speak Radio. This is David Swanson with Aidan Delgado. Aidan, how long were you in Iraq before you took a stand, and how did you take a stand?
I was in Iraq for just over 3 months before I began the formal process to become a conscious objector. But much earlier than that, even before I came to Iraq, I was beginning to have serious doubts, and I was talking to my supervisors about becoming a conscious objector. They told me to wait, see if my feelings changed, see if I could adjust. And so I did, and I did my best to fit in with the military. But about 3 months into the war, having witnessed in that short span more than I ever wanted to see in my life, I became convinced that it wasn't something I could keep internally. It wasn't something I could just personally object to and say, oh, I think this is wrong and I don't really like it, but keep doing it and not make a public statement about it. And so I began this enormous bureaucratic task of becoming a conscious objector, a path that ultimately took over 18 months from the beginning to honorable discharge at the end. And I began it not lightly, not on a whim, but after an agony, a personal agony of what would this do to myself? What would this do to my unit? How would people see me? Would I be viewed as a traitor? Would I be viewed as a coward? And all these things. And yet, all these considerations of what might happen paled in comparison to what was already happening. And the horror and the guilt and the shame that I felt being a part of this. And so that was what gave me the strength to go through it and to say, look, I'm going to make a public stand about this because not saying something, not doing something, is worse than whatever consequence they can put on me.
And at this point, you're not only in the military, but you're in what we sort of roughly call a war, a hostile occupation of someone else's country, and you put down your weapon and you refuse to fight. What sort of risks are you taking on the one hand, and what's the reaction? What was the reaction of your commanders and your colleagues?
Well, the risk I think was considerable, but I entered into it gladly and open-heartedly. At that point, I knew I wasn't going to use my weapon, even if I carried it. So it made no sense for me to carry it, knowing that I wasn't going to kill someone else. So in that sense, it was almost liberating to give up that last trapping of being a soldier. The reaction of my unit was, in the majority, very hostile. The people who knew me well, who were my friends and colleagues in the motor pool, and other members of my unit, they knew who I was. They knew I wasn't doing this politically or to get out of the Army. And so they stayed close with me. But almost everyone else viewed me, I think, as a traitor, as a sympathizer, and at the very best-case scenario, as someone who wasn't trustworthy. My command itself, that is my commander and my first sergeant, were probably the most hostile, and they took a number of acts against me, which I would consider retribution, such as revoking my home leave, taking away my body armor, assigning me to the worst jobs and tasks, doing everything they could to ostracize me. But really, these were so petty compared to what was at stake, you know, the kind of state of one's soul that we were all risking by participating in this war. And so whatever actions they did to me, I wasn't going to change my mind.
But to take away someone's body armor is at least symbolically quite a serious message that, you know, we would... We see no need to protect you from life-threatening situations.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is, and this is something I've gone over and over with my friends and the people I served in Iraq with, and I don't think that they were meaning to threaten me. I don't think they were trying to send a message that we want you to die. I think what they were doing is they're sending a message that you won't get any of the benefits of membership, like, okay, we're going to revoke our company, we're going to revoke our friendship, we're going to revoke our goodwill. And part of that is to take back these other things, some measure of protection. So I don't think it was a deliberately hostile or, you know, a deliberately aggressive act. I think they were trying to make me recant, and I think that they believed I would. Every member of my command told me that I will never become a conscious objector, that there's no way it will happen, that I'll give up, or that they won't accept it, and then you'll be right back where you started. So I think that they expected that I would fold, and so I didn't think they didn't have any concept that I would actually see it through for the 18 months that it took.
And how many, do you know how many people have successfully seen such a thing through in Iraq? I mean, my understanding, only about a dozen have even tried. Is that right?
Actually, this is a very interesting statistic and one that's held very close to the Army's chest. I don't think they like to publicize it because it makes it appear as if there's dissension in the ranks, which there is.
Of course there is.
The latest numbers I have from the Center for Conscious Objection is that there's been over 300 conscious objector applications in all the services. However, in terms of successful, honorable discharges, I only know of maybe 5 to 10 people who have been discharged. So again, it represents an incredibly small minority of people in the Army who even try, and then of those, another tiny sliver that are actually successful.
But this is aside from the many who have gone AWOL and the handful that we know who have refused this particular war as an illegal war. But this is 300 members of the U.S. military who have said, I am now a conscientious objector, although most of them have failed to win the honorable discharge.
That's true. I mean, we're talking about a large company's worth of people. And again, as you said, the AWOL and some of the political opposition tells the larger story in that there's something on the order of 5,000 deserters every year from the Army. So this is, again, maybe not necessarily constant objectors, but people who have a serious, serious problem with the military project.
Yeah. And when you finally got your honorable discharge, do you get any veterans benefits, or have they managed to cut those?
Well, no, I kept most of my veterans benefits, and as I'm fond of telling people who question, I said, well, constant objector or not, I did serve the entire year in Iraq, and I did everything I was ordered to, except kill, so I feel perfectly entitled to what everyone else gets for doing the same thing. I did have to repay my enlistment bonus, which I was more than happy to do, and they asked me about it on my constant objector application. They said, oh, you know, you're going to have to repay your money, and I said, I'd be happy to repay that money, because it would be a pleasure to be free of this commitment.
I want to get to a less pleasant topic, some of the things that you witnessed in Iraq, but I want to remind people first that this is the People Speak radio, and this is David Swanson with Aidan Delgado. You can call in toll-free to ask questions of Aidan Delgado from the U.S. or Canada at 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. Now, you witnessed things, Aidan, in Abu Ghraib, but also outside of Abu Ghraib. What were some of the first incidents you saw that really disturbed you about our conduct as liberators and bringers of democracy?
I sense the great irony with which you use those terms.
No, that
was something I was coming to grips with, too, because really as a young man, as a boy, as a naive member of the military, I had expected that soldiers would kind of hold the highest standards of heroism, the highest ideals of liberty and equality. And so going and actually witnessing a war was quite an eye-opening experience for me. We've touched previously on racism and xenophobia, and I think this is an incredibly important topic that's rarely raised in the public discourse, which is when you condition a people since September 11th, you know, when you condition them for 3 years before they're going into a war to view all Arabs and all Muslims as enemies, as terrorists, as people who hate life, as people who are lurking in the shadows to get you, how do you expect people to behave when they're around Arabs and Muslims? And this was played out in Iraq. I mean, Abu Ghraib was kind of the signature moment, but before that, there were dozens, hundreds of incidents of individual racism. And as I always say, it began very small. First, it's just an insult. You know, it's the haji, the raghead, the slurs. Then it becomes a posture and threatening, pointing your gun, pushing an Iraqi. Then it escalates to blows, to kicking in the door at night. And before you know it, you're at an Abu Ghraib situation. But it's a long escalation because people test the waters. They say, well, I'm going to say this. Can I get away with it? And if they do, then next time they go a little farther. Then they say, I'm going to hit this Iraqi or I'm going to throw a bottle at him. And if I get away with that, then I'll go a little farther. And the ultimate, the extremis of this, is that at Abu Ghraib, people say, well, I'm going to torture this Iraqi, and will I get away with it? And unfortunately, I think the message that's come through is that mostly you will get away with it, and mostly people will let you off the hook, and they'll make excuses for you.
And I know you had some familiarity with Arab culture and with Arabic language going in. Were you put in situations where you interacted more with Iraqis than others because of your language skills?
Absolutely. I mean, I was put forward as kind of the company translator, and I would go on all the missions into the city to communicate with the Iraqis, to get directions if we needed to purchase things, or just to get the pulse of what was going on in the city. So I actually had a very close interaction with the Iraqis in those first few months before I became a constant objector, at which point they sealed me away from all Iraqis. So I was always up and about and in the thick of it and witnessing how other soldiers in my company behaved with Iraqis. And many of them were very kind and generous and open. Many of them were neutral and indifferent. And unfortunately, some members of my unit were extremely harsh and I would say brutal with the Iraqis, completely unjustifiably. I mean, this was instances of not sort of the normal actions of a soldier, but gratuitous violence. you know, striking a child in Nasiriya with a steel Humvee antenna as a master sergeant in my unit did, or pointing your rifle in an Iraqi's face and telling him to get away from you for no other reason than for him standing and looking. And so, again, I think these tiny incidents are what sow the seeds for the Abu Ghraibs and for the Haditha massacres and everything later on, because they weren't stopped. There was no aggressive attitude of, hey, we don't conduct ourselves this way. We don't say those things. We don't behave this way. And so the tacit message is, it's okay. Keep it up.
Yeah, and eventually it becomes more than isolated spontaneous incidents if, as I think you've recounted, troops are keeping a supply of bottles in their vehicle to hit people in the head with. It's gained a certain level of routine acceptability, correct?
Yeah, and I think that's the key word that's not being talked about in Iraq is routine. What's the daily experience? What's the average experience? In a way, I almost feel like the highlight incidents like Abu Ghraib and Haditha, the real egregious acts, are almost a distraction because they focus the nation's attention on a few individuals, and we say, oh, what terrible people those few are, and oh, how they sully the name of our other soldiers, and we neglect to see, well, what about the average, you know, punch-in-the-chest kind of violence that goes on every day in every city in Iraq, and how is that affecting things? And if that's the climate, if that's the atmosphere where those kind of things are acceptable and perhaps even encouraged, what prospect do we have for winning the so-called hearts and minds of Iraq? When they see soldiers as not necessarily liberators, but as oppressors.
And what difference, if any, do you see between soldiers' views who are in active duty in Iraq and the views of Americans and ordinary American TV viewers? I mean, I spoke with a guy the other day who said, you know, and I maintained that no occupation like this has ever succeeded, and he said, well, Germany and Japan, and we got into all of the differences in how our nation conducted itself after World War II and what it's doing now, and he claimed to me that, well, you know, the big difference is the Japanese were more civilized than these Iraqis.
That doesn't surprise me, but it's very regrettable.
Where does that come from, and how do you begin to counter it?
Well, I think the problem was that we expected soldiers to sort of spring out of empty air and have attitudes completely separate from the American populace. And the truth was, if we're going to look back and be self-critical and be candid, after September 11th, there was a tremendous amount of anti-Arab, anti-Muslim sentiment that arose in America. In my own backyard of Tampa, there were mosques that were splashed with blood. There were Muslim people attacked in the streets. And it wasn't an isolated incident. But more than that, insidiously, this kind of language crept into our media. People began to characterize Islam as some sort of death fetish religion, that these people didn't care about life, that their civilization didn't matter, that they were ruthless, and therefore we had to do some unique special measure because we've never faced an enemy this brutal before. And all these languages, all these ideas crept into our national consciousness. And so why are we surprised when the people, the soldiers acted out on the ground in Iraq? They've been stewing in anti-Arab, anti-Muslim sentiment for 2.5, nearly 3 years before they were put in a position of occupying those people. So I think it's not that they're different, it's that they absolutely reflect our own society back home. And so the counter is not to focus on the army entirely, but to focus on societal attitudes and have just what they might call a zero-tolerance policy for this kind of casual xenophobia. We see it with the immigrant issue, but particularly we see it with Arabs and Muslims. And somehow, since September 11th, it has become okay in people's minds to look sideways at a Muslim American or to question the loyalty of anyone who's Muslim and to order Muslim men pulled off an airplane simply because they make you uncomfortable. And so it's reached a level of what I would call extreme paranoia that I think really directly contributes to the incidents that are going on in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Do you, I know this is quite a hypothetical question, but do you think that if Iraqis were Christian and white and spoke English, we could possibly be doing what we've done thus far, or would is the racism and the bigotry superficial, or is it necessary to permit these sorts of actions?
Well, they say that racism and xenophobia is always necessary to conduct war. That even when you face a white Caucasian enemy, such as the Germans in World War II, people conduct all kind of racial stereotypes, and they come up with all kinds of slurs. But I think it would be of a different nature. And I think the fact that someone has a different religion, has a language that's not even related to your own, and thus sounds totally alien, I think these things make it easier to push that person aside, to make them the other, to treat them however you wish, and so it becomes more severe. It's less easy to think of an Arabic-speaking Muslim as like you and therefore worthy of respect than I think it would be if it were a Caucasian or a European. And perhaps your listeners will find it provocative to say, but I really think that if we were invading a European country and occupying a European country, the occupation would not be this harsh and this brutal, and we wouldn't be talking about massacres and rapes and Abu Ghraib, because there wouldn't be that virulent clash of cultures or rhetoric that a lot of people hold. They really believe that this is not about a political dispute or even a terrorist attack, that this is about some kind of broad dispute between the so-called West and the so-called Islamo-fascist empire. And I think when you paint things in such broad black and white strokes, it encourages people to adopt extreme brutal measures.
I think you're right. We're going to have to take a brief break for a couple of messages, and I want to get to the topic of Abu Ghraib, although you've made an argument that it's a distraction from the bigger picture. I want to talk about it and about how you came to speak out about these things. But first, let me remind listeners again, this is People Speak Radio, and you can call in and ask Aidan Delgado questions live. The toll-free number in the U.S. and Canada is 888-228-4494. This is David Swanson. We're going to take a brief break, and we will be right back.
This is Pete Seeger. What country comes to mind when you hear this? The government illegally spies on civilians, produces phony news reports. People are imprisoned without charge or access to a lawyer. Prisoners are tortured and killed, and an illegal war launched on the basis of lies in which illegal weapons are used against civilians, against journalists and hospitals. Unfortunately, the United States government is behind these actions. Fortunately, our Constitution has a remedy. It's called impeachment. Ask your Congress member to impeach George Bush and Dick Cheney. This message is sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Are you looking for lively, intelligent, high-spirited debate about politics, social issues, and current events? Drop in on a new International Politics Lobby 8 room on Paltalk Community Chat, where over 4 million registered users worldwide participate via voice, video, and text chat. That's at paltalk.com, social issues category, room name, a new International Politics Lobby 8.
This land is your land. This land. join host Bassima Farhat on The People Speak as she interviews guests from the realms of politics, activism, spirituality, science, and entertainment. That's Tuesdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on The People Speak, an audience interactive program where your voice counts.
This land was made for you and me.
We're back at The People Speak Radio. This is David Swanson with Aiden Delgado. You can call in to ask Aiden Delgado anything you'd like at 888-228-4494. That's a toll-free call in the U.S. and Canada. Aiden, you described some of the offensive incidents you've witnessed in Iraq by members of the U.S. military. Kicking children, hitting children, threatening people with guns for no reason, hitting people on the head with bottles, etc. What was your reaction toward your buddies? When did you start to speak out, even in a limited way?
Well, actually, I mean, anytime I witnessed something, I would have an immediate response, the same way that if bystanders in America saw you point a gun in someone's face, they'd probably leap to intervene and say, "Hey, man, what are you doing? You know, stop this. This is madness." So I had just that kind of normal, everyday response that people would have in America. And yet in Iraq, this was seen as like a serious problem on my part, that I was, you know, soft, that I was not with the program, that I would even confront someone or question why they would threaten or hurt an Iraqi for no reason. So this was really, even before I applied for counter subjector status, this was the beginning of my ostracism from the unit. When it became kind of public knowledge in my unit that I didn't like that and I wasn't going to tolerate it and that I didn't support people doing it, and I was going to stand up and take the Iraqi side and say, "Hey, this is wrong." So I had that response almost immediately. And then I began to, the other thing that kind of drove a wedge between me and the company was that we would talk politics or we would begin to discuss issues. And I would discuss it from the point of view of someone who'd lived 10 years in the Middle East, or not 10 years, 7 years, 8 years in the Middle East. And some of these people had never left America. And we begin to talk about Islam, or we talk about conflict in the Middle East. And I would hear outrageous falsehoods, people saying things like Osama bin Laden is the head of Islam, or that Islam and Muslims are two different religions. And it just blew my mind, and I would have to say something, and I'd have to say, "You guys, you know, you're laboring under a misconception. Like, these people are, someone's telling you these things, and it's causing you to have an opinion on the Iraqis, which is just not valid. And you've got to talk about some of these other things." And so I think that they began to perceive in me that I wasn't an unquestioning supporter of President Bush, that I wasn't an unquestioning supporter of the war, and that I was perfectly willing to debate these things. And I think that was another thing that made people suspicious of me, and I of them.
And additionally, you've now taken a further step of not just speaking to those engaged in these actions, but speaking publicly. You're a whistleblower. You've written a book about your experiences, and you saw things at Abu Ghraib that were not, or were told secondhand, things that were happening at Abu Ghraib that were not just beatings, but shooting people who were behind wire and unarmed for throwing stones and posing with dead people in sort of trophy photos. When did you decide to speak publicly and to the media about Abu Ghraib and the rest of the occupation?
Well, when I came back to America, I was very gratified to see some of the word about Abu Ghraib getting out. You know, when I returned and a couple months thereafter, it was just beginning to filter out the extent of the abuses. But really, the moment when I decided, look, I'm going to tell not just the people in my unit this is wrong, but I'm going to tell America and I'm going to tell the world, was when I came back and everyone was so curious about the war. They always are. They always ask a returning soldier, you know, how was it over there? What did you do? Then always the question, did you kill anyone? Did you see anything? And I was so tired of dealing with these questions on a day-to-day basis, I thought, look, I'll just rent out my school auditorium and I'll have a presentation and I'll show slideshows and tell everybody the story, and then that'll be it, and I'll never have to talk about the war again. You know, ironically, this began a long campaign of speaking. But what I had to make a decision, right? Am I going to tell a very cursory, shallow-level story of, oh, isn't it hard to be a soldier, and, oh, you got to support our boys? Or am I going to go deep with it, and am I going to show the uncensored truth? And I decided that I can't censor my own story. I'm not going to cover up what happened at Abu Ghraib just because people don't want to think about it, and it makes them uncomfortable, the idea that we might be doing something wrong. So I showed it. I showed the images I had. I told the stories, some of which you just mentioned, about all the things that were going on at Abu Ghraib, the good and the bad. You know, I talked about us handing out medicine. I talked about us distributing food. I talked about the fall of Saddam. And then I talked about killing prisoners at Abu Ghraib. I talked about brutality. I talked about racism. I talked about taking trophies off of dead Iraqis. And because I just wanted to give a full picture and puncture this myth, this idea that soldiers are these pure, brave paragons and that they're not human and they don't have faults and they don't do brutal things in war. And I wanted people to get a sense of it. And unfortunately, people were shocked because they don't have a realistic perception of war. And that very shock, the response that people had, the horror, made me realize that this is an important service, that someone needs to go and just tell what really happened in Iraq. Tell what really happened in Abu Ghraib, because obviously people don't know it. Everywhere I go, I show photos, I talk about my experience, and Americans say, my God, I didn't know this was going on. I never saw photos like this. And that makes me think that I'm doing a good job or that I'm doing something necessary, because we have this cloudy myth of war as this vaguely heroic undertaking, and we don't see it as what it often is, brutality and horror and violence and death. And someone needs to go and show it and have the guts to talk about it. And I made that decision the very first moment when I decided not to censor my own presentation at New College. And I've never regretted it. And it's cost me a lot personally. I mean, I get lots of attacks and whatever. People disagree with me. People hate me. But I'm confident in it because I have such faith in the American people. I know that if they could just see what was going on, if they could just actually see it with their own eyes, see the images, see the video, they would reject it. They would not support it.
I strongly suspect you're right, and certainly we need to know what's happening before we can form informed opinions. We do have a caller on the line who may have a similar point of view or quite a different one. Let me remind listeners that you can call in toll-free to People Speak Radio at 888-228-4494. This is David Swanson with Aiden Delgado, and we have an Iraq veteran named Joe from Tennessee on the line. Joe, please go ahead with your question for Aiden Delgado.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for having me on the show. Hey, Aiden, I was an infantry soldier last year in Diyala Province, Iraq. One of the things that Iraqis told us quite often, the reason why they didn't tell us who the insurgents were, is because when we detained the insurgents, we'd send them to Abu Ghraib, and then they'd be released 3 months later, only to come back and be insurgents all over again. Now, you know, when we detain Iraqis, or foreign fighters, we have a target packet on them, which might have photos of that individual with weapons, with IEDs, or roadside bombs, right next to them. So these are not just regular farmers we just pick up and take to you. Why are you trivializing the prisoners there as us on the street being vindictive against the Iraqi people and us infantry guys just detaining innocent people because we feel like it?
Aiden, you want to take that question?
Absolutely. I think it's a great question. I'll let me answer the first part first. Firstly, I'm not trivializing the prisoner operations. I'm actually quite well informed about it, having worked in the battalion headquarters of Abu Ghraib. And I want to mention something you said, which was that people were reluctant to be arrested by the coalition or even questioned because they'd go into Abu Ghraib. And contrary, not 3 months, but very often they would go in for and be found innocent and not be released until 6 months later. So what we're talking about is not just an inconvenience, but a totally dysfunctional prison system, where literally Abu Ghraib was composed of 75% people who had been arrested by mistake. And that's not my assessment. That's from General Karpinski, the brigade commander who was in charge of Abu Ghraib. You can read about it in the Tigub report. You can read about it on the 2003 International Red Cross report. So really, it is actually what you said, the idea that most of the people in Abu Ghraib were either petty criminals or people who had been arrested by mistake. The overwhelming majority of them had committed no crime and had been caught up in a random sweep, and the overwhelming majority of them were not insurgents who had fought against the coalition. So I think that what you mentioned about people going into Abu Ghraib is very important, because a lot of Americans think that Abu Ghraib was only these dark, evil terrorists out to get us. And the truth was, from someone who worked in the headquarters and knew who was inside Abu Ghraib prison, the truth was that the majority weren't. And the second part of your question, I did not mean to characterize soldiers as wantonly brutal or abusing them just because they felt like it, and if I gave that impression, I apologize. What I mean to say is that, as you know, as an infantryman, violence and brutality are very common in war. And I don't think that we need to necessarily point at the soldier and say they're a bad person. But we need to really, if we care about it and we want to get rid of that, and we want to stop these people from embarrassing the army, we need to look at it and say, what are the policies that make a person do that? Why do so many choose to be abusive to Iraqis and so many don't? And how can we change the balance? How can we change the mix? What policies can we put in place? And I personally, maybe you agree with me, would like to see the Army take a policy of zero tolerance for racism against Iraqis, Arabs, and Muslims, the same way that they have zero tolerance policy for soldiers to one another. And I think that would be a great first step. And so I'm not meaning to imply that soldiers, just as you said, hit Iraqis or insult Iraqis because they feel like it. It's deeper than that. And it's about our society, the way it conditions soldiers before they go over, and also it's about the policies of the Army itself. And why, I mean, the question I want to leave you with is, why is it okay for a soldier to insult Iraqis, to make racist remarks about them, or even to push them? And it would never be okay if the same soldier made a racist comment against African Americans or Hispanic Americans. And I think that's the crux of the problem, is that we clamp down on one kind of racism in the Army, and then we kind of wink and nod and shrug off another kind.
I think that's an excellent answer, Aidan. Clearly there must be a cycle that's vicious here, because if you send young men and women from America over to Iraq with the idea that they are coming to liberate and to assist Iraqis, and they encounter, maybe not in those first months, but increasingly hostility from Iraqis, anger at the lack of reconstruction, anger at the permanent occupation that looks less and less like a liberation, and so that their actions of racist hostility toward Iraqis can even be reactions to
exactly what you said. It is a vicious cycle, and I detected, maybe I'm wrong on this, but I detected in the voice of this caller this kind of frustration that I hear in a lot of soldiers, the idea that, well, you know, some Iraqis really are bad and that we're only doing what we have to. And I think partly that's a valid perception, because unfortunately it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Maybe an American soldier goes over, he has a bad opinion of Muslims in general, he treats some of them poorly, so they get angry, they form a bad impression of Americans in general, so they behave aggressively towards the Americans, which justifies the original perception of them being hostile. And so the persecution only deepens, and the racism on both sides and the hatred only deepens, because each side is showing their worst face in reaction to the others. And that's why I think it's so tragic, because it's not that I'm saying that Americans are brutal or racist by nature. I definitely don't think that. I think that war makes people racist and brutal on both sides. And the problem is when we have a totally unrealistic view of what war is, and we send young men and women unprepared into a complex situation and say, you're heroes, you're liberators, do what you have to do, we're not giving them the tools to make healthy decisions.
Well said. We've got another caller. Let me remind everyone that you can call in toll-free to People Speak Radio at 888-228-4494. This is David Swanson with Aidan Delgado. We have Elizabeth from Massachusetts on the phone. Please go ahead with your question, Elizabeth, for Aidan Delgado.
Hi, Aiden. Thanks for coming on tonight. Since 75% of the people in Abu Ghraib were there by mistake, that left 25%, how did they decide who they tortured and what were the reasons why they decided to torture the people they tortured? And if you could, fill us in with a little bit of the methods that were used. Thanks.
All right.
Good question. Thanks.
I think this would be a good point to lay out the kind of basic structure of Abu Ghraib. Essentially, while I was there, there were about 4,000 to 6,000 prisoners. It fluctuates a lot. As you said, or as I said, about 75% of them had been arrested by mistake. But a point that is very important is that the Abu Ghraib prison wasn't only a coalition military prison. That had become the repository of the Iraqi justice system, meaning that since the Iraqi government had no functioning prisons, when people would be convicted of petty crimes in the Baghdad area, they would be sent to Abu Ghraib prison and serve time along with insurgents and coalition prisoners. So it was kind of a mishmash of civilian prisoners and then wartime prisoners. So of the other 25%, many of them, the overwhelming majority, were there for crimes against the Iraqi government. Petty theft, public drunkenness, kind of the usual roundup. So I don't mean to imply that everyone else was a ruthless terrorist. Now, of that group, of the 4,000 to 6,000 total prisoners, there were a small number, under 200 prisoners, who were what we might call high-value targets. These were the people who were suspected insurgents or were actual insurgents, and they were segregated. They were kept in a separate area called the hard site, which was an indoor facility. Most of the other prisoners lived outside. And that indoor facility is where all the iconic abuse took place, the torture, the humiliation, the sexual acts, the dogs, all that. That took place inside the hard site with a very specific subgroup of detainees. And I think the decision to instigate that abuse was related to their status, the idea that these are the cream of the crop of the insurgents. These are the very highest, most dangerous insurgents, and therefore we need to soften them up for interrogation. And this was a theme that came up over and over again in the Taguib report and in the ensuing investigations. The idea that the military police weren't acting on their own, they weren't acting spontaneously, they were acting at the whim of military intelligence and maybe with some intelligence contractors. And the idea was, hey guys, take these prisoners, we're going to interrogate them later on, but make sure they have a really bad night. You know, make sure they really suffer this week to kind of break their spirit in preparation for an interrogation. So that was really the motivation. In terms of the methods, there's a stunning array of methods that I could only touch on. One of the things that I really encourage every American to read the Taguib report, not just skim it, but actually read several sections where prisoners testify about what happened to them and they show photos, because that really tells a lot more of the story. But some of the highlights were military dog handlers allowed their dogs to bite and savage Iraqi prisoners. Many Iraqi prisoners were photographed in the nude. Some of them were sodomized with objects or photographed in the nude in front of women. Many of them were beaten severely, and just a whole array of things. Kept in freezing temperatures, kept awake for days at a time, shackled to metal bedposts for days at a time. So again, just a whole range of tortures, and really the Taguib report tells the whole story. So I hope that helps fill in some of the gaps.
Aiden, do you know Sam Provance? Did you know him then, or have you run into him since?
I have run into him in the days since, but I didn't know him then.
He is the sergeant from Abu Ghraib who went to ABC News. Quite a courageous act, would you say?
Oh, absolutely. There were so many very brave men and women at Abu Ghraib who took a stand and took far more risks than I did. His name is temporarily escaping me, but one of the specialists in that company who came forward with the abuse and showed the CDs to the inspectors was incredibly brave in that respect, and it suffered tremendously. I mean, he had been placed into protective custody for fear of reprisals against him. So these are the real whistleblowers. You know, and I'm just sort of talking about what happened to me in Iraq and what I personally witnessed, but these were the people who blew the lid on the whole thing.
But you've not had an easy reaction to the step you've taken of declaring yourself a conscientious objector to what we are supposed to believe is a moral and decent project. It can't have been easy. Would you recommend to others that they refuse to fight, that they blow the whistle on crimes?
If they feel it sincerely, if they feel it strongly enough that they believe that they're a conscious objector, I wouldn't let any fear of reprisal stop me, and I don't think they would either. Because one of the points I want to mention is that, yes, I suffered when I was in Iraq. My unit did everything they could to make me suffer. I've suffered since I came back. I mean, a lot of people disagree with me. A lot of people hate me for even questioning the administration. But it's all right, because I didn't do anything in Iraq that I'm ashamed of. And more so, I upheld my conscience, and I upheld what I believed in, while everybody else was losing some of what they believed in. And that's priceless, and that can liberate you through any difficulty. So I would absolutely encourage people to follow their conscience.
Well said. Aidan, we don't have a lot of minutes left. I want to make sure everyone is aware that you have a website at aidandelgado.com, that you have a widely praised book recounting your experiences called The Sutras of Abu Ghraib, and that you can be seen in Iraq for Sale, in Soldiers of Conscience, and in The Ground Truth, among other films. And I heard a rumor somewhere that you're considering possibly in the future running for political office. Is that a possibility?
Absolutely. In fact, that's one of the things that's motivated me and inspired me since I've come back, because I've spent so much time on the streets being a protester, giving speeches, talking about injustice, that I've grown sick of being just a voice in the wilderness. And so one of the things I want to do is I want to get involved in the political process. And so I'm looking in my future, when I'm a little more experienced, to possibly running for office.
Mind if I ask whose district you live in?
I would be in the Florida 13th District.
Who is the 13th District Congressmember?
Oh, it's Congressman Buchanan, but it was a very close election. He narrowly defeated Christine Jennings in what was sort of a spurious Florida election. But so in Sarasota, where I went to college, would be the area.
Yeah, well, we could certainly use you. I would say the sooner the better. But thank you, Aidan, for everything you're doing. And this is the People Speak Radio. We will be back next week when the guest will be Houston Smith, the author of The World's Religions. Thanks, Aidan.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Take care.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the city wall, by the relief of the I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters.